I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The New York Times printed an essay adapted from Heather Havrileski's new book, Foreverland, on the divine tedium of marriage with the eye-catching title, Marriage Requires Amnesia. Do I hate my husband? Oh, for sure. Yes, definitely. Well, readers were outraged. Here's how the hosts of The View responded.
She calls marriage a funny thing, and then she says, it's insane and completely deluded to set out to try to stay with the same person until you're dead. And the madness of the venture creates comedy at every turn, because obviously we fail and disappoint ourselves all the time. I think that's all true, but she wrote it down. And I think she wrote all
these things. Better to keep it quiet.
You know, she wrote all these things down about her spouse in a book, let alone, you know, you don't say things like that, I think, to your life partner.
What the thing I like about it.
Well, they clearly hadn't read the book. Heather Havrileski loves her husband deeply and writes about the annoyances, the conflicts, compromises, the absurdities that come with being in a long-term committed relationship. She wanted to be brutally honest about her marriage, and some of it is tough to read. Some of it is laugh out loud funny, and some of it is very familiar. She joins us to talk about why marriage is the world's most impossible endurance challenge. That's a quote from the book. Heather Havrileski is a journalist. She's a writer of the advice column Ask Polly, also the author of several other books. And Heather Havrileski, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. So nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Has the outrage died down after that initial piece in the New York Times?
Well, I mean, that started, that piece ran at the end of December, and then there was a review in the New York Times that was a little bit curious by a man who felt that marriage was a secret, and that I had done a grave disservice to my husband by writing the book. And then there were tabloid headlines based on some other coverage that said things like, wife hates husband, confesses, you know, wife confesses that she hates a husband. One said, wife says she fancies another, calls marriage insane. And so it's, I would say that it's, overall, it has not really died down.
Well, and I should say, you do say all those things and more. Let me just quote a couple of sentences. And this was when this appeared in the New York Times. It was actually on Christmas Eve. You write, until Bill, this is your husband, has enough coffee, he lies in a jumble on the couch, listening to the coffee maker, waiting for it to usher him from the land of the undead. He is exactly the same as a heap of laundry, smelly, inert, almost sentient, but not quite. But then you go on to say, other times I experience Bill is a very handsome professor, a leader among men, a visionary who has big ideas about the future of science education in America. This is clarity. So there in the first page, I mean, it's clear you're looking at both sides of this person.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just this morning, I mean, just this morning, I walked into a room and my husband was drinking his coffee in the dark in a corner. And I tried to turn on a light and I said, are you in here? And he said, yeah, I like to drink my coffee in the dark. So there's a way that he treats himself like a pile of laundry in the morning for one thing. And the other thing is I'm trying to, with that passage, I was really trying to express the idea that in a marriage, because you're with the same person for so long and they're in your house, there are days when you have an almost confused or, you know, out of body experience of their existence where you just feel like this is just an obstacle. I'm trying to go about my day and this person has become almost an object that's blocking my way. So it was a comedic metaphor.
Well, what
makes sense?
It does make sense. And what we hear in that view, I forget who says it, which is essentially, we just don't say these things out loud. But did you feel as if you were breaking some kind of a taboo about how we talk about marriage?
Well, I mean, I set out to write the book for sure in order to write something funny and real about marriage. The books I had encountered up until the point where I started my book were mostly memoirs either about divorce from the perspective of someone who'd already left a marriage, or they were memoirs about a marriage that was still going on, but everything I heard about the marriage and their spouse sounded sugar-coated to me. Like I couldn't, even though you're talking for pages, writing for pages about a marriage, I never felt like I could get a sense of what the marriage was really like. And so I wanted to take my marriage and make it the subject of a book, partially because I felt like I've got this great marriage. I love my husband. It's unshakable. And I should be the one who dives in and says, marriage is actually difficult, even when your marriage is great. So that was the intention. Along the way, I found it was a challenge to write about my marriage. It was a challenge to question my marriage at all. And that's probably why people are a little bit allergic to the sound of someone who is interrogating the concept of marriage at all, because it's a danger. It is a dangerous thing to do when you're married. It's a hard thing to do. By the same token, it yields pretty amazing results, and it actually drew me closer to my husband over time.
Yeah, and we will definitely get to that. But it is interesting to combine humor and honesty, which I think are often so misunderstood, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also earnest sentiments. When you're talking about the full range of emotions that you feel, I do think that is, something that it's hard to do in a book. I mean, a book is a big thing. There are many pages, but it's so tempting to be reductive about human relationships, or to pretend that you're better than you are, or that you're the hero of the story. And with this book, I really wanted to avoid that feeling and that sense for the reader. I didn't want people to experience me as some kind of incredible wife and mother. I wanted people to see mostly the challenges of some of the roles that we put women into, and the roles that we put two married people into that sometimes don't fit, that are difficult.
And we should add that your book is dedicated to your husband, kind of confusion there. Well, I would love to have you read actually the very, very first page. It's titled Beginning, and it's just two paragraphs there.
Sure. Okay. Beginning. Every book about marriage is also a book about mortality, since the success of any marriage is defined not by happiness or good fortune, but by death. The assignment, after all, is to stay together until you die. Once one spouse perishes, the marriage has succeeded. Death signals victory. Only an optimistic fool would declare victory before reaching the finish line. That's what makes weddings such dark comedies. What's more entertaining and ominous than watching two naive souls sign a binding contract without understanding the fine print? Most engaged couples bumble onto the marital bullet train without even knowing where it's headed. All that matters is that we'll be together, they whisper to each other. Forever is two immortal elves, sipping champagne by a burbling stream, and then exploring the wild, gorgeous woods around them in everlasting harmony. Forever is set in New Zealand, not New Jersey.
I had to laugh out loud with the reference to our state here, New Jersey. That's Heather Havrileski reading from the very beginning of her new book. It's called Foreverland. And if you want to join our conversation, I invite you to do so. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Made you want to really put a microscope on your marriage for the rest of us to read about?
Well, I wouldn't say that I was motivated to expose myself necessarily. I think that what I was motivated by was the fact that I have all of these experiences and stories. I mean, I've been writing professionally for 26 years. I've written 3 other books, and I've written about myself a lot. I write about myself in my advice column, Ask Polly, that's on Substack constantly. And so I think that in a way, because I use myself as a bad example in my advice column often, as a means of saying, everyone is like this, we should have compassion for ourselves, we all mess up. I think that sort of opened the door for me to say, you know, I can write funny stories about my marriage and about raising kids, but I can do it in a way that I'm not saying, you know, I'm not either saying it's all a joke and there's no way to succeed at this. And I'm also not saying, you know, a good person, a magical golden person like me just sails forward through life easily and nothing is difficult. I sort of felt like it was an opportunity to not only entertain, which is always my, honestly, my first priority as a writer, but my second priority is to say something true and to make something memorable about out of my stories. And so to me, as I wrote the book, I almost made the book more honest as I went along. I mean, I think that it wasn't that I set out to, oh, you know, I'll expose us, honey, and everyone will know
hang on,
how
right?
terrible we are. This will be fun. It was more just this feeling like, of course I have to include this story. You right. know, I would come across these stories and I would ask Bill and he would, my husband, and he would say, that's a great story. You should put that in there. That absolutely illustrates a certain thing. And so the New York Times excerpt, it was an illustration of anger. Part of that was traveling with my teenagers in Australia and having a lot of difficulties because of their moods and my mood as a middle-aged woman. And so a lot of the stories just sort of, I didn't necessarily intend to include them, but I'm drawn personally to stories of failure. I love to feel, I love it when people expose when they feel like they're failing. And so I did a lot of that within this book.
Well, and getting back to what you were saying about how people either write or talk or even think about marriage, it is a kind of binary, right? That it's either is this or it is that, rather than it's all these things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people like for you to believe that they have great marriages, and they also rightly feel fear that if they tell you something about something that's a little off or a frustration, or if they use too strong language around what their spouse is doing or how their spouse is making them angry, they're afraid that you will see their marriage as a bad marriage. And that's sort of, unfortunately, how we've been trained to see marriages. We have this fantasy that you fall in love and you kiss, and of course we have a million stories about that part of the
sure.
about that part of the picture, and then you're supposed to stay in that state of being in love and passionate for the rest of your life. And if you can't manage that, there's something wrong with you, or you should get divorced. And that was, in fact, the reaction to the New York Times piece. You should get divorced was something that a lot of people sent to me in public. In private, I got tons of notes that said, this is just like my marriage. I completely get it. I think it's funny. So people who've been in marriages for a long time, it's not that they're miserable. They just know that a marriage is so much more layered and there are gray areas. And it's more interesting, actually, than we make it out to be.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Heather Havrilesky about her new book. It's called Foreverland on the Divine Tedium of Marriage. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Heather Havrilesky. She's a journalist. She's a writer of the advice column Ask Polly on Substack. She's also the author of several books, including most recently a marriage memoir, and is titled Foreverland on the Divine Tedium of Marriage. Heather, let me read a couple of comments from some of our listeners here. Kate says, it sounds to me like Heather and her husband are both very honest with each other and loving. Here's an email from Rebecca. Once we get married in July, my fiance and I will have been together for a decade, navigating a wedding industry that's full of those couples at the babbling brook. I'm so grateful for a real description of the mundane, the challenges, and the deep happiness of long-term relationships. I cannot wait to read more. Any comment to our listeners there?
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I mean, I personally am someone who finds it comforting to read sort of the potential trouble that lies ahead. I mean, I like stories that sort of warn you about what could happen within reason. I mean, I think that in some ways, we sometimes talk about childbirth like it's this, you know, carnival of horrors. And in, you can definitely sort of overdose on these like negative messages and confessions and, you know, my marriage was a nightmare all along, and you never knew. But I feel like what I was really trying to do with this book was sort of give the little mundane ways, the ways that you get cold feet, the ways that you feel irritated, but it's not really your fault. It's normal, actually, when you're adjusting to living with someone around the clock, to feel irritated by them. Because partially what I wanted to sort of address is that we tend to tell stories about what it means to be irritated and what it means to feel like someone is letting you down and what it means to feel like you're letting yourself down. We don't have a lot of good language for just muddling through the world and accepting ourselves and forgiving ourselves for who we are. Animals that sometimes get impatient and sometimes feel lust and longing at inappropriate times. We are humans and we are flawed. And our culture doesn't necessarily support us in all of our flaws.
You write about being, even as a little girl, that you wanted a husband, you wanted to be married. And your husband, Bill, before you became a couple, wrote you a fan letter. And when you met each other, as you say, it just felt like you, quote unquote, matched. It just fit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that doesn't happen every day. Did that make you feel like this was kind of a fated, you know, you were fated to be together?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I learned when I met him was, you know, in some ways it was like, God, this is exactly the way I imagined it. I imagined a tall man with a handsome face and brown eyes and a good jaw. I mean, that sounds kind of shallow, but there were ways that everything that happened felt like this fairy tale that had come true. And I think that when you're really in it and you're in love and you just feel like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I'm going to get everything I've ever wanted. It's, you know, it's finally happened. There's almost a way that the little things that don't match that fantasy bother you more than they would if you weren't, you know, thrilled and in love and happy. I mean, it's almost like you raise all of your expectations up to the level of fantasy, and then the small things, why is he wearing those shoes? I don't understand. You know, my prince should not be wearing shoes like this. there are ways that those expectations create trouble. I mean, you can see that in a wedding. Bridezilla is the result, the direct result of the heightened expectations and fantasies and the cost of a wedding.
I was thinking of Bridezilla, a show I haven't seen in a while, but I did watch for a while because it was just, you know, the level of temper tantrum and horribleness was so entirely on display.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to be that person.
No.
That's the last person in the world you want to be. And I mean, part of that is we live in a misogynistic culture that loves to make fun of a woman, you know, falling short of her own expectations and showing bad behavior. And yet, on the other hand, you know, you don't want to be that person because you assume that you won't be that person. You look at Bridezilla and you say, I am above that. I'm going to be a graceful, glowing bride. Hmm. But then on the day of your wedding, your entire family, you know, ideally, I guess, is there witnessing this moment that you've paid all this money for, and all your friends are there. And it's almost like you've created this incredible spectacle that it's very easy to fail at. It's hard to play, particularly if you're not that great at playing a role when expectations are high, which I discovered in my life is a kind of a recurring theme.
Well, this is a little sidebar, but I thought when you met Bill's son, Zeke, he was about 9 years old, you would beat him relentlessly in Monopoly. And what were you trying to say to this young kid?
Well, it was that classic, unfortunate clash of your intentions and the reality of who you are. And at the time, I've had two more kids since then,
right?
You know, and Zeke was my stepson, and I met him at age 9. So I didn't, I was not a parent, and I did not understand children at all. I used to say to Bill, why is he acting like a 5-year-old? He's 9. He should act like a 9-year-old. I mean, I wouldn't say this to Zeke because I knew better than that, than to be scolding him and haranguing him. But part of it was just that I didn't understand that a 9-year-old boy sometimes acts like a 12-year-old boy, and sometimes he acts like a 9-year-old boy, and sometimes he acts like a 2-year-old. Like, that's just how 9-year-old boys are, or 9-year-olds in general are like that. So it was my lack of familiarity with what a child even was. And then on top of that, you know, Monopoly was like my favorite thing. And I wanted to give him the joy of Monopoly, right. You know? Unfortunately, my joy in Monopoly at the time was very much tied up in strategy and winning. And so my theory was, if you don't lose a bunch of times the way I did when I played when I was little, then you won't understand how great it feels to win.
Wow.
But by the same token, I could not stop myself from winning. Like, I would never, I would give him money to, I would let him borrow money, but I would never, I'd always sort of say, well, I told you to buy everything. You're not buying everything yet. You have to, you know, he wouldn't match, you know, he wasn't being a good apprentice. And so I was like, well, that just shows you that, I mean, I was a harsh person.
Well,
basically.
Indeed.
I hadn't been
a harsh capitalist,
into a parent
I think.
Yet.
Yes, right. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Heather Havrileski. She writes an advice column called Ask Polly. She's a journalist. She's written several books, and she's got a new one called Forever Land on the Divine Tedium of Marriage. Let me read an email from Grace. She says, I've been married for over 32 years. I still believe that marriage is a thing that any person gets into without any clue as to what they're signing up for. I love my husband to death. Does it mean that I would marry him again with all that I know now? Perhaps not. They say when you know better, you do better. Bravo. I mean, you know, people do get to that point where they realize that this is not, maybe you stay together, but this is not who I want to be with until death do us part.
Yeah. And I think that's healthy. It's healthy to know if you want a different kind of a life at some point. For me, I discovered that I was commitment phobic for the first time after I got engaged. I think that until you're staring at someone who absolutely wants to be with you forever, you know, or until one of you dies,
right.
That's when you realize, you know, you can't even tell if you're a commitment phobe until someone is incredibly, absolutely committed to you. So I had cold feet in the beginning with my husband. And I also, in the book, describe situations where I wonder, are we really going to just live together, watch each other grow older and decline, and then it's over? Like, is that really how this is going to go? Couldn't I have, you know, a different life, 5 different lives? Like, suddenly your options in life and what you're going to see for the rest of your life seems limited at times. And when your mortality enters the picture, it kind of changes what you're doing and how you see things. By the same token, I never felt like I'd made the wrong decision. I mean, even at my darkest times, I mean, I was going to destroy my marriage. Pretty much, you know, I'm a person who can destroy things, certainly. I can be very negative. So it took that belief at the bottom of things, you know. I had to find my belief over and over again. But my core belief never changed, that I had found someone that was really right for me and matched me and was a good partner for me. I think it's really hard when you don't have that, actually. And I think that, you know, that's part of what my message is that, you know, it pays to question these things and to look at them, because you have one life and you need to seek joy no matter what your circumstances are.
Well, I'd love to have you read another section from the book. And this is actually about Bill, your husband. It's on page 106.
Yes. Okay. Bill can be very defensive, but he does listen. If I'm not visibly pissed off, he'll let me speak for a long time, and he doesn't zone out or drift off, unless we're in bed and it's late, in which case my words are just the lullaby he needs to fall into a deep slumber. Bill tunes into my metaphors, even if I'm mixing them together incoherently. he tries hard to understand the feelings I'm trying to express. If I try to communicate a feeling and I throw in a lot of ideas around that feeling, which some people would find intolerable, Bill becomes more interested, not less. I don't think that's a common trait among men or even people in general. I don't think most people listen even more closely after 10 minutes of a very emotional diatribe. As long as there's no blame involved, as long as I can describe reality without making it seem as if it's all Bill's fault, then he'll hear and he'll eventually get it.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, to listen so carefully and with such intention.
It's pretty special.
It's
a gift. It's definitely a gift. I mean, I had dated a lot of men before, and I had been in long-term relationships before I met Bill. I mean, I met Bill when I was 34. So I was accustomed to, I felt like I kind of knew what, you know, my type of man, I guess, is a narrow category, was I knew what they were like. A lot of men can be defensive. They sometimes get bored easily when a woman is talking. You know, I mean, this is unfortunately how it feels to be a straight woman in our culture sometimes, is to feel kind of like discounted and ignored. And so when I found, I mean, I had plenty of boyfriends who were good listeners, but when I found Bill and we started talking, a big thing that stood out was just that he was really open to new experiences and new ideas. And he was thrilled by the fact that I had a complicated mind, which I think is, I write about this in Ask Folly a lot. There are women who really need a man who loves a complex mind that dices things up very quickly and sharply and enjoys seeing that as opposed to feeling afraid of it.
You do write, you sort of referenced this earlier, but you do, I mean, you're an advice columnist, so I'm assuming people have written into you about how to handle an affair or what, you know, why they had affairs. You had an emotional affair with an unnamed author in this book. What do you think you were looking for that seemed missing to you?
Well, okay, so first of all, I would not characterize that as an emotional affair because this author was not someone I knew very well. I had met him at a dinner and he hit on me at the end of the dinner. And then the story has twists and turns, but I did not approach him and say, hey, what happened? What was that? I sort of thought he was going to explain himself at some point, but we were in casual contact about, you know, very mundane subjects, and we never really talked about what happened. I was not, so we don't really have, I mean, I don't actually know him that well, and I didn't know him that well then. So to say that it was an emotional affair is a little bit off. I had a crush on him, created by the fact that he hit on me. Mm-hmm. And then I told my husband about it immediately. Like, first I told him that the guy hit on me. Then I told him, okay, I'm starting to think about this guy. I have no idea why. I'm starting to fantasize about him, and it's, you know, it's gross and I'm sorry. And my husband was like, you can fantasize about people. It's okay. We're married and I trust you. And then slowly it became this obsession where I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to approach this guy. I mean, he was married and had kids. I didn't want to say, hey, what was the deal? I didn't want to push it. But I also couldn't let it go. So why did that happen? I mean, I think that people can be married for a while, you know, and, you know, the crazy thing about it was I sold this book about my marriage and then someone hit on me. So I had to write about my marriage while I was a little bit obsessed, and it was difficult. It was like, it was almost like the gods were messing with me. That's how it felt. It felt like, Jesus, why am I in this crazy situation? And, you know, the one thing that got me through it was the ability to talk to Bill about it honestly. I mean, he got tired of hearing about it, but he was very patient and extremely confident that what we had is a good thing and that he didn't need to be worried about it.
Which is probably why you felt like you could tell him about your fantasizing about this person. Would you say, though, it opened up a conversation that it allowed you to have like a better marriage, a better relationship, because he knew perhaps what your fantasies were?
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't really have that many fantasies before then. And fantasies are kind of good for you. It's weird because it's sort of it's a cliche of the Cosmopolitan, you know, article of like, you know, tell him your fantasies, buy lingerie. But I became this sort of weird cosmopolitan wife along the way, where I was ordering lingerie and talking about my fantasies. And it was, I mean, it's embarrassing to me to talk about that. I'm not necessarily someone who loves going straight to the heart of like, how to spice up your sex life. How's your sex life? That's not really my conversational realm or even stuff that I talk about that much in my advice column. But it was great for my marriage. I mean, it was really something that we enjoyed together. Instead of feeling like some kind of nasty woman who had betrayed her husband, I ended up sort of sharing this sort of feeling of new renewed energy about my life and this new sort of feeling of desire for like experiences and adventures. I ended up sharing that with my husband, and it made our marriage a lot better.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Heather Havrileski, our guest today on Radio Times. She writes the advice column Ask Polly. She's a journalist. She's written several books, including a relatively new one called Foreverland on the Divine Tedium of Marriage. We're going to get another reading after this short break, and we're going to take your comments and calls as well. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Heather Havrileski about marriage, about her marriage, about long-term relationships. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Heather, can you read a section from page 220? And this is a chapter titled Angry Birds.
Sure. I have that.
Yeah, 220.
220, okay. Love and hate are intertwined, sometimes to the point where they're almost indistinguishable from each other. I need you, therefore I hate you. I can never leave you, therefore you are my bunkmate in this prison we freely chose back when we were younger and even stupider than we are now. No sooner are you saved than you start to resent your savior. Marriage is a solution to several problems that creates infinite additional problems. Marriage can cure your loneliness or exacerbate it. Marriage can make you feel a lot stronger than you really are and a lot weaker than you really are. Marriage can feel like a soothing meditation retreat or a dirty tryst or a very long lunch with the most head-splittingly repetitive human who ever walked the face of the earth. Every week is a little different than the last. Sometimes anger is replaced by indifference. Sometimes anger is replaced by love. Sometimes anger is replaced by outright rage.
Hmm. And that's Heather Havrileski reading from her new book, Foreverland. I remember interviewing a husband and wife psychologist team, the Gutmans, and they had looked at sort of why some marriages survive and why others don't. And they found that one of the sort of cardinal reasons that a marriage would fall apart was when they saw contempt, not anger, mm-hmm. but when they saw contempt between the partners. And that has always stayed with me because I think contempt is not anger. It's you have no respect or regard for that person that you're with.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That stayed with me too. I read about that a long time ago when I was in a relationship that was absolutely, there was a lot of contempt in it. And actually, someone who interviewed me about this book asked me, you know, you write a lot about how much contempt there is in your marriage. And I stopped and said, no. Anger is not the same thing as contempt. Anger is an emotion that you feel in the moment and you have to work through it. It's a very raw and direct thing, like sadness or joy, where you feel, you know, your heart is racing, your hands are sweating, and you feel like something needs to be done. Someone needs to, you know, someone is treating you unfairly. Contempt is a state of not respecting someone's needs, as you said,
right.
not being able to honor their desires, and not really being able to see them because you're so resentful and so tired of being treated in ways you don't like that you can't even hear what they're saying almost. I mean, in the relationship I was in where that was typified by, you know, contempt, that contempt was like a major feature of the relationship, we went into couples therapy and he would talk about his feelings and I had this feeling like of a complete void of empathy for him, which is an awful feeling, you know, to look at someone who's crying or upset and what, you know, or angry, and I couldn't hear him at all. So I think that when you're faced with that, I mean, that was a haunting aspect of that relationship, and I ultimately got out of it partially because I realized that we couldn't escape our contempt for each other. Bill and I, in my marriage, we have moments of anger. We have fights. It's not that we never clash. It's just that when we have big clashes, we tend to be very good at talking them out until we both feel better. And then we both apologize and we, you know, recognize that we're both very flawed people who can be rubbed the wrong way easily. Sometimes we're oversensitive. And we've always been good at forgiving each other and forgiving ourselves. Now, forgiving ourselves less so, but we've always been good at forgiving each other and moving on.
Yeah, it's hard sometimes to forgive oneself. You do, though, describe a visit. Your mother came to visit, and she says to you, or maybe to both of you, I worry about the state of your marriage. And marriages go through, you know, it's a cliche, of course, ups and downs, you know, good times and bad. But mm-hmm. it's interesting that she said that out loud. And your parents divorced when you were, you know, a girl. And it sounded like it was tough.
Yeah, I mean, my mom was a little bit paranoid early on in my marriage that I was going to drive my husband away by being so, critical and needing things to be a certain way and being so expressive of my emotions. And Bill and I, in the scene in the book where my mom says that, we're both saying to her, we just aren't sleeping well. You know, we have a toddler and a baby and things are, you're seeing like a snapshot of this sort of really difficult part of our timeline. But part of what's hard about being married is that it's so easy for other people to misunderstand where you are. A marriage is almost like a series of snapshots. And unless you have the kind of Bible of your marriage for someone to read, they're going to look at a snapshot and say, oh, they're perfectly happy together. Oh, right. Look, they're so joyful and they enjoy each other's company. And oh my God, look at them bickering. They really don't get along at all. So it's hard to share the layers of what you're experiencing, you know, behind closed doors, I think.
Here's an email from Tony. An algorithm on a dating site pointed me to my wife. The first question she asked me when we met was, so tell me about your divorce. And then she said, if I'd given her a bunch of bull, she would have ended the date. She's always sure she's right. She knows exactly how things should be, whether it's how I stack the dishes or what clothes I should wear. The truth is, she's much smarter than I am. We laugh every day and hug several times a day. After 10 years, I still feel love flowing out of my heart for her. I mean, that's quite lovely, Tony.
Oh, that's right. I mean, what's interesting is you can hear about someone else. Someone can describe their marriage in intimate ways, and you can automatically think, well, that's not what I want.
Of course.
You know, like that sounds a little weird. But within the marriage, if two people are happy, I mean, within reason, there are ways that people just decide to, they invent their marriage together. You know, it's like you're creating this work of art as a team.
You're right about the fact that, I mean, I think for any and all couples, and especially couples with children living through 2 years of the pandemic, was a huge test for the relationship. But you also got a cancer diagnosis. First of all, how are you feeling?
Oh, I'm great. Feeling great. I was diagnosed with a small amount of breast cancer, and it was surgically removed, and I'm doing great. I never had to have chemo, so it wasn't the worst thing in the world. I did have a series of operations during the pandemic related to the cancer, so that part was definitely taxing. At times, we were not only at home, but also in Los Angeles. There were fires, and it was smoky outside, so you couldn't even leave the house. I also had my stepson and his girlfriend living with us for about 3 months of the pandemic early on. And with my two kids schooling from home, two bad dogs.
Nightmare.
just a total clown show. It was kind of an interesting challenge. Overall, I would say that was a kind of a happy year, even though it's almost like, so there are times in your life when you have big challenges that are just very concrete. And even though it's, you know, you have to rise up and meet the challenge, there were ways that, you know, global pandemic sort of made my husband and I rise to the challenge well. I found 2021 to be more difficult, actually, because a lot of the trauma of 2020 caught up to me. And it was just we made decisions, we moved across the country. It was ultimately a more stressful time.
Did you feel, talking about marriages that, until death do us part, that, getting the diagnosis, the cancer diagnosis, did that cross your mind that this could be the death that parts us?
Yeah. And the fact that I was trying to wrap up a book about marriage and I had started it with the word death, that was not the ideal situation under which I can write, the end of a book. It was really difficult. And also, but I was raised Catholic. So actually a layer of me just thought, oh, I'm being punished for being a terrible wife and for having this crush.
Wow.
And for, I think like once a Catholic, always a Catholic at some level, where you have all this like, this has meaning. I'm paying for my sins. So, this is just another reason why understanding how you feel and really reflecting on the sources of your feelings is so important because within a marriage, because you can't, if you don't understand your feelings, you will have a tendency to take it out on another person. And I think like understanding the things that are working on you culturally from your past, from the present, all of those stressors, looking closely at those stressors. I mean, this is something that I write about over and over again in my book. Although my book isn't prescriptive in any way, I wanted to really go to those places where you're forced to really look at yourself and say, my God, what is working on me in this situation? Why am I reacting this way?
Well, you describe, I think both you and your husband, Bill, going through sort of this period of sleepwalking. I think that's the word that you use to describe where I guess you're going through the motions of your marriage, but not really experiencing it or being in it, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. There was a period before the pandemic where I felt like Bill was busy, I was busy, we were raising kids, everything was just, the conversations we had were sort of like, logistics team meetings or something, it was like, I was calling the conductor and saying, hey, there's another train coming in or whatever. We were never really connecting and sharing our sense of humor and talking about what we wanted and what we believed in. And so I think it's easy for a married couple to fall into that, particularly when you're both running the factory of your house together and you have so many responsibilities. And we had to kind of, find each other again after that.
you mentioned joy, and I think for, you know, it's sometimes it's hard to find that in a long-term relationship or where it becomes work and no play. It, and I know you don't give advice, but how do you, how do people find that if it's not sort of on the menu, so to speak?
Well, my belief is that you come to each other in a state, a vulnerable state, a calm state, a state where, you know, you're feeling okay. You're not, you haven't just fought or anything like that. You're sort of, both people are feeling pretty safe and okay. And you tell each other, honestly, if you can, the things that are pressing on you and the things that are, you're worried about. And also you share your desires, your deep desires. And part of that is maybe your fantasies. Sometimes it's your fantasies about yourself. There's a point in your life, I mean, I think in middle age in particular, you look at your life and you think, what was I supposed to be? How much time do I have left to become my fantasy of what I was supposed to be? And I think talking about fantasies and disappointments and how much time you have left, these things really open the door to a new kind of energy of generosity. It can be that you find each other within this spirit of generosity and forgiveness. And then you're able to actually say, what do you want to do with your life? And how can I support you in that? And vice versa. I mean, that's what you want to be. If you can't live in that space, it's hard to be married. Yeah. But if you can, there's no reason that you can't actually stay with someone. If they're interested in honoring your full self and you know you want to give them that gift and you can position yourself in that way, there's really nothing better. And there's a way that just being in that space and saying, we're going to seek joy. We are going to be committed to living exuberant lives, even in the face of all this sadness and conflict in the world. When you can enter that space, it is joyful in and of itself. To land there is a way of feeling joy right now, today, just by having a conversation.
Yeah, in spite of everything, sometimes it feels. Here's a tweet. Yeah. I know many people who each day feel more in love with their spouse than any previous time in their marriage. The secret is not being selfish and caring at least as much about the other person as you do yourself. I mean, hard to argue with that, right, Heather?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you become more generous, though, when you're generous with yourself, and you become more forgiving to your spouse when you forgive yourself for your flaws. And so sometimes it has to start with a feeling of almost selfishness, a selfish need to understand and support yourself. And then you can come into the marriage and be a more generous and loving partner.
We're nearly out of time here. And now that people have read the book and talked about it, maybe without even reading the book, are you pleased with what you wrote?
Oh, yeah. This book is really, the, in my opinion, it's the best thing I've ever written. I've been writing for a quarter of a century. I've been at this for a long time. And this book is just, I mean, I was very, very careful to show my whole marriage and also to make it funny. And I think that I pulled that off. And I'm very, very proud of this book.
Well, on that note, Heather Haverleski, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Absolutely. And I enjoyed the book as well. She's a journalist. She's a writer of the advice column Ask Polly on Substack. And the book is called Foreverland on the Divine Tedium of Marriage. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org. Look for Radio Times under programs. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.